John Coltrane with Isaiah Collier and Lakeisha Benjamin, and A Day in the Park featuring Kamasi Washington, the Stanley Clark Band, Miles Electric Band, and more. For further information, including full schedule and tickets, go to smjazzfest.com.
Hi, this is Elliot Gould, and you're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse collective of feminists. And every week we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. Because we want you to know a little bit more about Feminist Magazine, who we are and how we do it, and why you'll want to support feminist radio on the air on KPFK every week. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like. Feminist Center for Creative Work is in the final week of hosting their Spring 2026 Artist in Residence project. It's called Marooning Bodies, Prototype as Prophecy, and it's presented by artists Mims and Moy. And we're joined today by one of those artists. We're joined by Mims, and we're also going to hear from Kamala Polikandla, who is the co-director of the Feminist Center for Creative Work. We want to hear all about this inspired artist-in-residence project and also talk a little bit about next week's grand finale event. So welcome both to Feminist Magazine.
Thank you for having us.
So Mims, I would love to start with where this project is rooted. And the whole project is called Marooning Bodies. It's been developed over several years. Can you tell us a little bit about the rooting and what inspired you to begin this?
So I started Marooning Bodies about 5 years ago, actually during the pandemic. I had a dance fellowship at NYU, and I couldn't go to New York, and I couldn't access studio space here in LA. And I didn't want to make a dance video in my apartment. And I was really inspired by another project I have called Gel Bed Drop. And it is a performance and interactive installation. And I love the interactive installation component. So I was really thinking about how can I create a tool that is a container for people to imagine and really massage our imaginations, to engage in nuanced discourse and, you know, be facilitated through that in a generative way. And also a tool to practice relationship building and sustaining skills. I come from a background in dance and community organizing, and I think a lot of times people have great ideas, but we don't have the actual relationships skills to sustain some of the things that we're building. So that was really important to me. And then I started thinking about play and the state it puts our nervous system in, and how that really is a great, like trust building and relationship building tool to be in that space. And yeah, came to an idea of the game. I have no background in game design. And so I reached out to some USC professors because I went to USC. They connected me with some game design professors, and they connected me with two students who they thought would be interested in helping me. And so Matthew Kupleton and Christina Leilon, I think for about 2 or 3 years, we were on Zoom. They were really helping me bring this vision to life. And there's been so many points of influence. Like, I'm also a big fan of the work of Bayo Kamalafe. And so the name came from a podcast I was listening to from him. I thought I made it up because I was thinking about a name for a long time. But then I've listened to this podcast like 5 times, and he says it in like a very poetic way when he's speaking about marinage. And for people who don't know this, Maroons are African people who escape slavery and form new communities. So this idea of marinage and marooning comes from that. And it really broadens it into the sense of like, how do we remove ourselves from any sorts of systems that are not helpful for us? And I don't even know if the word is removing now that I'm speaking about it, because I also think marinage can be practiced inside of the heart of empire. And there's so many examples of that. And so this idea of marooning bodies is how do we practice marooning? Whether it's in the scape, in the sense of like removing ourselves, or if it's in the sense of building something new, whether that's separate or within this thing. But how do we do that with our whole bodies, our physical bodies, the body of the land, other species we share this earth with? And so that is where the name Marooning Bodies comes from.
I love how you connected to both a potential escape, but also being able to do it here and now, and within and underneath the umbrella of everything. So just to explain to our listeners, players sort of build a fictional society through a game, and there's prompts, dice, cards. Can you walk us through a little bit of that just to give us a picture?
Yeah, so players play in up to groups of six. And like you said, they're building out their ideal community. And there is a future histories textbook. And that is what Mui designed. She designed the book once I finished playtesting for like first 3-4 years. And it takes players through sections of decision-making, resource distribution, community rituals and practices, and responses to harm within their community. And throughout that process, they're also creating an art-based artifact. So this can be a song, a dance, the creation story of this community, or a letter to two generations away. And there's adaptation cards in the game. So there's a use of biomimicry. They're pulling a social behavior from different species. There are color pencils that they use to write and draw in the book. There is a timer that they use. It's like this really cool vintage timer. Dice and a scent vial. So I also worked with a scent designer, and he created a scent for each biome. So the first card that players pull is their biome card, where they're building their community, really rooting them in the ecology of the place. One of the tenets of the game is really about like human beings aren't the center of your community. And I think rooting them in place is really important, especially in having them consider that in all of the decisions that they're making. And so the scent designer, he created a scent for each biome. So each box has a different biome card and a different scent vial with a correlating scent. That's the only thing that is different from box to box. Everything else remains the same.
I love how much you're talking about community organizing, community building. And I think that's something that Feminist Center for Creative Work has been doing so well in so many ways. Kamala, can you tell us, just briefly tell our listeners a few sentences to acquaint them with FCCW, and then how you decided to bring in this artist in residence program?
Yeah, I mean, okay, I think the Feminist Center for Creative Work is an arts and community center, sort of vaguely, broadly. But we definitely strive to bring in art and projects like Mims and Moy's project that introduce the concept of how to build a feminist world. And it's not explicitly like just intersectionally feminist, but there's a lot of cool ideas within the questions and the game that Marooning Bodies is bringing into the space at FCCW that we are always asking ourselves too. So I think the question of like, how do you want to build together? What do you want to build together? How do you want to treat each other in various circumstances that sometimes are great circumstances and sometimes are a struggle? I think those are questions that we're often asking ourselves. So it's super aligned to have brought in Marooning Bodies, especially at this time, because we opened our space, our new space, at the end of 2024. And so we're still very new at bringing people together in the space. And this is such an inspiring project to think about what it means to build a community when you're rooted in one place. We were introduced to Mims and Moy's project, I think a while ago, but it's just beautiful to see it now up in the space.
Yeah. And Mims, you did an opening day of games, right? And were there things that surprised you that came up at the beginning of this residency and that you had not expected, despite your playing through possibilities?
Not really. I mean, we did two game sessions in here. I'm always surprised by what people create. I mean, I went through years of playtesting, so there has not been any big surprises in terms of gameplay in this current stage because, you know, I think I playtested for 3 years and here in LA, in New York, inside of prisons, in Morocco, in Senegal, and Ghana. So I really made sure that things were in a space where I don't have any big surprises.
And so players are grouped together up to six, right? And they get this box of materials. And how much time do they have and what kind of prompts do they get? I'm trying to imagine this with our listeners.
They have about 2 hours. And at the end, they present this creation that they created. I normally do the sessions 2 to 3 hours and give people buffer time when it's 3 hours to kind of get in the door. Prompts. Okay, so like I said, the first thing they pull is this biome card. They get their resource distribution strategy by rolling dice. They get their decision-making strategy by rolling dice. And this was helpful at the early stages of playtesting. Things were too open-ended. So it's nice for people to have limitations in terms of rolling the dice and them being forced to work with a certain strategy, even if it's not the one that they want. It actually, what I learned from the two game designers I was working with is that was actually creating room for more possibility, because when it was too open-ended, people couldn't imagine outside of what they already knew. Which reminds me of like a lot of the sort of ideas of marooning that I've also seen inside of prisons and jails. Like in these very carceral and limited spaces, like the innovation is insane. Back to questions, prompts. So I'm thinking about the section of community rituals and practices. They go around and talk about current or ancestral practices in their lineage, and they get to share and then think about either from those, what do they want to bring in their community, or do they want to create a new one together? But in terms of the order, it's the biome card, the adaptation card, decision-making, resource distribution, community rituals and practices, and responses to harm. And they get others props up under those sections. I also my background is in dance, and so the idea of this being a full-body experience was something that's really important to me in engaging the senses. That's why I brought in the scent designer, but also in the ways in which I wrote the questions, I didn't ask them to write, you know, their community values. I asked them, what are the flavors of your community values? And so that actually leaves room for a more nuanced conversation, because then we would kind of just get the same answers of respect, responsibility. But when you are talking about it from a flavor and taste standpoint, the conversation gets a little bit more nuanced. There's so many prompts in the game. The book is, it's a 2-hour process, so I don't want to.
Wow. I love how you've explained that to us. And it's The gameplay is generating an archive of future relics from a speculative world, is the quote. And so in a way, it's creating the archive with intention, correct?
So archiving what players are making, and then these future relics are items inspired by the future histories created through gameplay. So I've been working with McBog Design on a collective prayer stool. And then I've also been working with Flemings on a wearable artifacts collection. And it's really exciting to bring these future relics to life and kind of, I like to think of them as rehearsal spaces for some of the things we would like to see in our communities. And for me, I think about all, like my background's in dance, I think about all of this as choreography.
Yeah, very much so. It feels like that there's a sense of possibility and then space and all these things to move within. I love as well that it's about community organizing and that, but about imagining possibility. So rather than so much of organizing or activism feels like resistance rather than creating what we might imagine that we want. What kind of feedback, Kamala, have you guys been getting at FCCW from people who've walked through the game or been, you know, part of the experience?
It's been incredibly positive feedback. Like, I think that Mims explaining the game doesn't even quite capture the experience that people are having in it because they form these extremely intimate bonds. And, you know, Mims can also tell stories about this too, but I think the act of dreaming together really brings people together. They feel very protective sort of the little societies that they're imagining. And they get really specific in the things that matter to them. And I just don't know if people are invited on a regular basis to sort of connect with strangers like this. And like, people are really into it. People are creating group chats and, you know, really getting to know each other.
Yeah, I feel like there's a hunger, right? For this, for more of this.
Yeah, definitely. I also think that there's something about the future relics in the space. I think they do help people, like, it, as Mims was saying, like, sometimes people can't imagine beyond what they already know. I do think that's kind of what the installation and the space helps offer to people, is you have a visual, and if you take this open studio tour with Mims, like, you learn about some visuals that are offering you a perspective on a different way to think or interact with materials that you have seen before. And I think that's also really inviting and exciting for people, including me. Like, I love it. I think it's a really cool exhibit.
And that's sort of that whole thing of shifting perspective. And Mims, what you were saying about our limited imagining and then sort of creating these prompts and sensory, like, scent is like our most strong memory nudger in so many ways.
So another one of the guidelines and tenets that I wrote at the beginning of the game is that remembering is a part of imagining. So in terms of you mentioning that, that is also a big part of the game.
Yeah, because I think we might have sort of creative or expansive ways of thinking when we were younger, you know, that have been crunched and contained out of us. And so the opportunity to have those memory moments, I think, reconnects us to spaces.
Yeah, and I think
like
also
that.
Our bodies,
it's possible to do that,
hold so much more memory than beyond what we've even physically experienced. Like, ancestral memory is living in the body.
Right.
So it's like, you know, I really didn't want something where we were up here. That was very important to me when I was building this out. I don't want world building that's just happening in the mind, but this is full body dreaming.
I love that. It's a t-shirt.
Running by the t-shirts coming soon.
Yes, full body dreaming. I mean, who wouldn't want to? Let's talk a little bit about this closing event that you have on Saturday, April 18th. At Feminist Center for Creative Work. And Kamala, do you just want to give us a little bit of the framework of it? And then we can ask Mims to describe what what the event is going to be.
I think you should have Mims describe the event. I will tell you, it is starting at Feminist Center for Creative Work. It starts at 6, and there is a food element that I think Mims can talk about.
I'm excited to collaborate with Hazard Kitchen on edible relics. We've been doing a lot of playing, but we ended up moving in the direction of each food item is basically the, each edible relic is in relationship to one of the actual future relics in space. So it's like, what does the collective prayer stool, how do we get that why, those values, those intentions into something that is edible? And we did that for the Steward's Jacket, Chain Gang and Blue, which are the other two relics that are in the space. So that's just been really beautiful to translate those intentions, those whys, and those future histories into something that is edible. And Zoe, who runs Hazard Kitchen, is just so brilliant. I used to just attend her immersive dinners that she throws. And so I'm like happy to be doing this with her, happy to be centering like foods that are really important to the diaspora and playing with those and being creative with those things. And so, yeah, I'm really excited for what we're making.
And it's going to be relics shaped by African diasporic food pathways, improvisational food cultures of the U.S. South, and the familiar ritual of the gas station snack, which the combination...
Who doesn't love that?
All of it. Who doesn't love that? Exactly. So that is going to be happening Saturday, April 18th, starting at 6 p.m. And Kamala, where can folks find out more information about that?
You can find information on our Instagram at Feminist Center for Creative Work. It's a long handle, but it's there. You can also visit our website at fccwla.org.
Great. And I would like to just talk a little bit, last question, about the readings that I saw you had posted, Mims, readings in speculative fiction, Afrofuturist genres, to give our listeners something to go away with, you know, like a little homework. Books that you would recommend.
Oh, so many books that I love. So I guess I won't say a specific book, but I'll say folks. So like I mentioned, Bio Kamalafe, I think he shapes my thinking a lot. And he has books that you can read. One is called These Wilds Beyond Our Fences. A lot of podcasts he speaks on and is interviewed. I love listening to him talk. There's a great interview of his on For the Wild podcast. Sophie Strand is another one of my favorite thinkers. She has articles on Substack. She has tons of interviews that you can find. And then I just read, one of the last books I read is her newest book called The Body is a Doorway. Incredible, incredible. One of those books that I feel like really changed my life, that gave me things that I'm like, I'm going to be chewing on this for a long, long time. Wow, there's so many books. Maroon Choreography by Fahima Ife. I might be pronouncing her last name incorrectly. And we have a lot of the classics, Octavia Butler, Audre Lorde, Alexis Pauline Gums. We have some Joy James on the table. Also, I want to highlight, I have two of Dana Casperson's books on the table. She works at the intersection of conflict and choreography, and she was one of the people that really gave me lots of feedback in the early stages when I was like, I really want to create a tool that, you know, creates generative conflict. And how do I do that? so she has been here the whole 5 years giving me feedback. And so I really appreciate her commitment. And so I have some of her books on the table every time. I think she's written two books throughout this whole journey. So when she writes one, she always sends it to me in the mail. And it has really not only shaped how I've gone about making the work, but even sort of on the internal levels, how I'm actually navigating conflict when working with institutions. And, you know, for the stool, I'm working with the county and parks and things like that. And so I'm like, all of the things that are all of the values and the intentions that are being held through the actual makings and playing of the game, I am attempting to practice internally as well. So, yeah, just shout out to Dana Casperson. And I think that her books and her work are extremely necessary.
I think we could all use some greater skills in navigating conflict with institutions. But that's another conversation for another day.
Can I say briefly also that just because this exhibit is closing doesn't mean that there are no more Mourning Bodies gameplay? Like, Mims, you have a couple more sessions of gameplays coming up,
I have one at a library May 17th and then one June 6th. So there will be, Marooning Bodies is not over.
Okay.
This is like,
yeah,
this is my practice.
this is how I'm going about my practice.
So I'm continuing to not only do gameplay sessions, but I'm also continuing to make relics. Only the first two of the collaboration I'm doing with Flemings is done. We have seven more to make. And then outside of that, I'll continue to be making, have way more ideas for relics that I want to continue to make. So.
More of us need to be in these places of the imagination that you're creating. So thank you. I've so enjoyed talking to both of you. We've been talking to Mims and Kamala Poligandla. Mims is part of the Feminist Center for Creative Works Artist in Residence Project. Kamala is their co-director. And this is the final week hosting this whole spring Artist in Residence Project. Please check out and find out about the closing event. See if there's a tour still open for you. And we will have all the links for that on our website and social media as well.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Lynn.
Family. If you haven't already, I invite you to tune in to one of KPFK's strongest traditions, our Spanish language slate, airing Monday through Thursday, 8 p.m. to midnight. A rich mix of public affairs, environmental justice, immigration news, deep dives into Latin America, and of course, music that moves the soul. It's community radio at its finest, an español for la comunidad. So tell a friend, spread the word, and listen in Monday through Thursday, 8 p.m. to midnight, right here on KPFK 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. Familia, les tengo una invitación especial.
To engage in any activity
that shall contribute
to a lasting understanding
between nations and between the individuals of all nations,
races, creeds, and colors.
To gather and disseminate information
on the causes of conflict
between any and all of such groups.
And through any and all means
compatible with the purposes of this corporation.
To promote the study of political and economic problems.
And of the causes of religious, philosophical,
and racial antagonisms.
That is our mission. Yeah.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin. And coming up next...
There's something healing about being able to go back into African histories and see what we are capable of.
Afrofuturism is a genre movement rooting elements of science fiction and fantasy in traditions from Africa and the diaspora. And its popularity as a form of resistance is on the rise. But Afrofuturist concepts have been prevalent in music and literature since the 1950s. You've got jazz musician Sun Ra and authors Samuel R. Delaney and Octavia Butler.
The surrealists believed that you have to first change your dreams in order to change the world. And I feel that that's what speculative fiction, any kind of speculative fiction, people writing, black comics, they're imagining a better world. They're dreaming a better world, a different world. And I realized that's what I wanted to spend my life doing.
On this episode, authors Nalo Hopkinson, Nnedi Okorafor, and Jewel Gomez sit down with John Jennings at the San Francisco Public Library as part of the 2016 Black Comics Festival. They discuss the role of Afrofuturist thought in the modern context and the importance of allowing ourselves to imagine. I'm your guest host, Charlotte Landis, and you're listening to Making Contact.
When I sit down to write, I don't think I'm an Afrofuturist writer. I'm going to write an Afrofuturist whatever.
Nalo Hopkinson.
I'll happily claim the adjective. It happened after I started writing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is a label that people use to try and pull together a pattern that they're seeing. And in so much as what it is, it's useful. But... It is also not as simple as I'm just a writer. Of course, I'm not just a writer. I am everything that I am. But the Afrofuturism part is, it's got to be somewhere else when I write, or it will stop me. I'm writing science fiction fantasy, so there's a lot of research that goes into it, and a lot of, not just research, but theorizing, because, of course, the history books leave stuff out. So you have to imagine yourself into those places. I'm researching the future, I'm researching the past, I'm researching black history, Caribbean history, white history. I barely stayed awake through a history class when I was in school. And now, if you look at my shelves, that stuff is all over the place. And I discover the more I go into it, the more I realize that human beings are human beings. You can reach back into the very beginning of time when human beings are human beings, and we aren't that different. And there's something healing about being able to go back into African histories and African cultures and African ways of life and see that what we are capable of, which, you know, but to see it proven over and over and over and over again as the centuries go by and the centuries go forward.
I definitely... look into my past.
Nnedi Okorafor.
I am what I consider Niger-American, which means Niger is slang for Nigerian, and I'm American. So Nigerian-American. I was born and raised in this country, but from a young age, my parents were taking me back to, my siblings and I, back to Nigeria to reconnect with our heritage, reconnect with our family. Most of our family is there. And then also just being Nigerian American in the house, within that culture, within the Igbo culture, those old traditions and ways have seeped into who I am as well. So those all manifest themselves. My Nigerian Americanness definitely manifests itself in my work. I deal a lot with the traditional spiritualities, especially of the Igbo people, but of other parts of the continent as well. One example are masquerades. Masquerades show up in my works a lot. Masquerades are found in many different African cultures, but I have like a lot of what I write about comes from personal experience. So my personal experience with masquerades. Masquerades are like they are manifestations of the dead and the ancestors and spirits. And there are many different types. Some can look very monstrous, like, you know, just raffia in cloth that they can look like monsters. And those are the ones that I've been obsessed with. And so when I was a kid, whenever we'd go back to Nigeria, the masquerades would come out around Christmas time, that's a whole other issue. You come out around Christmas time, and because my sisters and I were American Nigerians, they would harass us the most. And they would literally chase us down the street. Okay, they would chase it. They had like a whip, and they would whip people, and they would chase us down the street with the whip. And luckily, we were fast, so we weren't caught too many times. So when I think back, I'm like, okay. And a lot of times we would outrun them. And so when I think back, I'm like, oh, I was outrunning the spirits. And so in my own stories, you see the masquerade show up a lot in my stories, and they show up in a way where they show up in the way that I imagine them, because I've seen the really big, terrifying ones at weddings, and all the women just run to the other side of the room. It's just, it's really quite epic. And in my stories, because I'm writing speculative fiction, I can imagine those masquerades the way I see them, which is as they're not people or men in particular dressed up in these elaborate costumes who then take on the ancestor or the spirit. They are that creature. Mm. And so in my stories, I can do that. I can show them that way. And I have a lot of fun with it. So I do look in the past.
I would love to hear if people have specifics about what prompted them to write their first.
Jewel Gomez.
Mine was based on a very specific incident that happened to me in the mid-80s. Does anybody here remember telephone booths? Okay. I was in a telephone booth at the corner of my street. I guess my phone wasn't working or I had rebelled and not paid the bill. So I was in the phone booth, and these two guys walked by me and went into their whole thing. Oh, baby, let me suck your blah, 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 and I want to do this to you, and oh, you're looking so good, as if that would interest me, their opinion. And I was talking to my friend, Marianne, and she said, what's going on? I said, hold on a second. I turned and looked at them, and I said, please go away. And then I turned back to Marianne. Well, of course, they didn't go away. They just went on and on. I said, hold on. I turned around. I said, motherfucker, I will kill you if you don't get a fuck with me. And one of the guys said, this is crazy. And the other guy was just like, kept on going. I said, yes, I am crazy, and I will kill you. And used a lot of that language that my grandmother had asked me not to use. And the one guy dragged the other guy away. And this was on West End Avenue and 93rd Street in Manhattan. My adrenaline had gone through my body like crazy. I was so happy there was nothing at hand for me to pick up.
Right.
Because they keep West End Avenue kind of clean. So my friend, Marianne, I heard her screaming, Jewel, 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 because she thought I was killing someone. So I said, Marianne, I can't talk. I have to go home. I can't talk. So I went home, and I caught my breath, and I sat down, and I wrote the first Gilda story.
Mm. Wow.
And it was a woman walking in on the street, and a guy does that to her, and of course she kills him.
I'm so going to use that when I teach the Gilda stories.
Tosses his body in the river. So I decided I better use my powers for good.
Please.
And over time, you know, evolved the vampire mythology, because that's really what I realized I was working on, so that she didn't have to kill people, and developed the whole philosophy around it. So that fit into my political, mm-hmm. social political philosophy mm-hmm. as a lesbian feminist. And I felt like, you know, the surrealists believed that you have to first change your dreams in order to change the world.
Right.
And I feel that that's what speculative fiction, any kind of speculative fiction, people writing black comics, they're imagining a better world. They're dreaming a better world, a different world. And I realized that's what I wanted to spend my life doing, as opposed to, you know, killing people on the street.
I keep going back to Walter Mosley, who you may or may not know, has written science fiction novels and short stories.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
And I'm going to paraphrase him, but he basically said, we need a better world, and in order to have a better world, in order to make it, we first need to be able to imagine it.
Mm-hmm.
And also Samuel R. Delaney, mentor of mine, who said, we need visions of the future, and our people need them more than most.
Mm-hmm.
So,
That's right.
It was true then, true now. And so there is very much a connection. And I sort of also think, the work is there. The work needs to be done. It's desperate. But we also need to be able to enjoy, to have fun, to have imagination, to have passion, because why else are we doing this? So I think we also need to give ourselves permission to enjoy. The work is there, and we will do it. So there's very much a connection between allowing ourselves to imagine, allowing ourselves to think that we get to, like anybody else, have fun, and using that to fuel the vision of what it is we're trying to make. Sometimes I just want to write strange stories set in strange places. My own reality will always seep into those stories. But I want to hold on to the fact that we get to do all of it.
Right.
Yeah, I'm sitting here thinking about the word using these narratives for social justice, and I'm very resistant to that.
Yeah.
Because I know that when I sit down and to write something, I'm not thinking that, okay, I want to make this point. You know, this is something I want to show the world about whatever. When it comes down to it, when I sit down to write, I'm not thinking about anything. I'm just letting it flow. I'm a very subconscious writer, where oftentimes I don't even have an outline. I don't even know who the character is. I'll just sit down and just start. And whatever is flowing through me is what will flow through me. So the idea of using the narrative for something is foreign to me. I mean, I understand other writers, other artists who operate like that, but for me, I definitely don't. But I do know that I'm very much a political person. So those ideas and what I want to see, the changes that I want to see, and the things that I want to do and want to see done, those are already there. Those are things that I might have conversations about when I'm not writing. But when I sit down to write, those things come through in a more a more indirect way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, I deal with, my books tend to be very political, and it's not that I sat down and thought, okay, I want to write this political story. It's just that they are, because I am.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say the same. I think I might be a little more conscious of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think I start out to write agitprop, but having come of age, you know, in the civil rights movement, the black arts movement, all of the work that people were doing was an expression of liberation and opening new worlds to us, the worlds of blackness. So I think I started writing in a very conscious way about blackness, the same as being a feminist. I started writing very consciously about women and how women are placed in the world. At the same time, I don't want to write a tract, you know,
of
so
course.
People will just, you know, snore. But I think, though, having come of age in those particular movements make me much more conscious of it as I'm doing it. And I think that's one of the interesting things for this, going from African-Americans saying, how dare you write a vampire novel with African Americans in it. How could you do that? How could you connect those things? To, you know, 25 years later, as my vampire novel is about to have its 25th anniversary, and a new edition, to see the community come full circle and say, oh yeah, we're going to claim this and we're going to give it its own name, Afrofuturism. You know, it's really great. And in part, I think that's because the political evolution on campuses, in communities, poorer communities who are starting to understand their economics has to be taken in their own hands.
Right.
They can't wait for the government to fix it. That racism, sexism, any of the isms really need to be in our hands. How we fight them need to be in our hands. And I think that is a sign of hope. And I think that's one of the reasons that our writing has started to spread out into these fields, into black comics, into future Afrofuturism, and other speculative fictions. I think it's a sign of hope.
You're listening to Afrofuturist authors on Making Contact. Nalo Hopkinson is the author of 9 books, from Brown Girl in the Ring to the Nebula Award-winning Sister Mine. Nnedi Okorafor writes African-based science fiction for both children and adults, including the Nebula and Hugo Award-winning Binti series and Akata Warrior. And Jewel Gomez is a writer, activist, and the author of the Double Lambda Award-winning novel, The Gilda Stories. Her dream play, Waiting for Giovanni, is about James Baldwin. For more information about these authors, visit the Making Contact website, radioproject.org, where you'll also find past episodes. You can sign up for news about upcoming shows, like us on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter at @making_contact. You can also find us on Instagram at Making Contact Radio Project. Please rate us on iTunes. It helps other people find us. Now let's rejoin the conversation as our three authors discuss the monsters that have captured their imagination and what they hope to see in the future of Afrofuturism.
I'm sitting here trying to figure out why this monster is so central to so many of my stories. There are two. One of them is Godzilla. And this is why I'm sitting here trying to figure out, okay, because Godzilla has shown up in many of my stories in various ways. And I know that if someone were to just ask me without intellectualizing it, why do I like Godzilla, it's Godzilla's destructive nature. Godzilla comes out of the water and just destroys There's no rhyme or reason, just comes out, destroys everything, and then goes back into the water. I love that. I don't know why. I don't know why. There's something about it. And it may have something to do with my obsession with post-apocalyptic narratives as well.
Okay.
This idea of everything being destroyed, you know, and then having to deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
It also may have to do with my anger issues. I don't know.
Get it somewhere. All right.
A lot of rage. The second monster, it's not really a monster. It's just this entity that has shown up consistently in my works now. It's in Lagoon, and it's in Akata Witch Part 2 as well. And it's this spider. It's this giant spider that is, its name is Udide, which means spider in Igbo. The first time the idea of the spider showed up in one of my stories, it was in my story called Spider the Artist, which deals with the Niger Delta, where you've got like these, it's set in the near future, where you have these, the government and the oil companies have created these robot spiders to guard the pipelines, the oil pipelines in Nigeria, can prevent people from bunkering. And these spiders, of course, they kill anyone who touches them. They just tear them to shreds so that they can guard the oil. So that's sort of another story. But this spider is not Anansi. I know that. I'm terrified of spiders. I don't know why. It's an irrational fear. And so spiders have always shown up in my stories, but this particular large one, it lives underneath the city of Lagos, and it turns onto its back and feels the vibrations of the people. And it's a monstrous spider, and it weaves and creates stories and narrative and controls everything. It's just... Yeah, so that's my second spider. Yeah, I'll stop there.
Okay, so I want to stop and read that story like right now.
Yeah.
What? Okay.
Well, I guess my monster started out as those two guys on the street, and has evolved to any figures that prey upon people who are less, powerful.
Right.
And I think that was one of the reasons I was interested in doing vampire stories, because Dracula is such a pervasive mythology, such a pervasive character, and insidious because he's charming and he's a serial killer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you go back to the original ones, that he, seduces women and kills them. And everybody is like excited. Dracula's coming over. You know, I'm like,
is it?
So that really fascinated me, that people would find this such a romantic figure in such a predatory figure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I remember one day I went with my mother and grandmother to see the play Dracula on Broadway. We left that and went to see the movie with Frank Langella, which was playing in Times Square
time.
And we were in conversation about that for hours. Like, how could he be so sexy and be such a killer?
Right.
That really set me up to work on how to redo the mythology so that I felt like vampire could be heroic and not a predator, not a serial killer. And in this new book that I'm working on, it's about the society becoming predatory, using people who are empathic, using people who have certain kinds of skills, artistic skills, and making them work for the government, segregating them into patches so they only associate with people who are doing what they do. And how to escape that. So the monster is really those who prey on less powerful people.
It is Stagoli, it is Papa Legba, it is Ishu. It is that tall, lean man, dark man in the top hat, who knows more about the dark in you than you do, and knows that you want it.
What I'd like to see, and what I think is going to, we're going to see more and more African writers from the continent,
that's right.
You know, writing Afrofuturist stories. And I think that the change that I've seen, because I've had a lot of interaction with especially Nigerian writers. And what I remember from maybe about 10 years ago, There was this general attitude of what is real literature, and science fiction and fantasy and speculative fiction were not considered real literature, and what was considered real literature were like Things Fall Apart, you know, serious writing without any of that weird stuff going on in it. But I think that we'll see more Africans directly from the continent writing this kind of literature, and I think that what they write is going to have like a different flavor as well. And what I also would like to see in terms of Afrofuturism is just more diversity in the types of writing. I'd like to see female writers, writers with disabilities, just more variety within Afrofuturist writing.
Right.
That's what I'm waiting to see, because right now it's so small. You know, and it's slowly building and it's increasing and growing. But I'd like to see more of that. And I'd also like to see really an extremely successful Afrofuturist writer, extremely successful, as in like best-selling status, yes. Who's mediocre.
Wow.
I want to see that. Yes.
Nice.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yes.
All right.
Okay. I want to see that.
For me, the idea that genre fiction, and I usually say speculative fiction to cover everything as an umbrella term, but I think speculative fiction is really an easy way for a large population to find themselves and find their politics. Mm. Any kind of genre fiction, whether it's detective stories, whether it's cartoons, whether it's a romance, I know you find that hard to believe, but any kind of genre fiction can get away with telling a political story. And if it's a genre fiction, more different kinds of people are going to read it because they feel like, oh, this is just going to be fun. And then when they finish, they realize, oh wow, I thought about that. That was right. Deep. And whoa. And, you know, you saw Star Trek do it with issues around race. We see all kinds of TV speculative fiction shows introduce complex ideas. And I think the more of us who write and start writing younger, the more complex ideas we will put in genre fiction, and the more of us who will read them and become increasingly conscious of our political surroundings.
I hope it gives more people permission to know that they can imagine and that they can make stories. I mean, I think the three of us were at Astro Blackness a few months ago, and there was a young woman in the audience, black woman, who also loved horror and didn't think she could write it because she kept imagining black characters until she found an ARC, an advanced reading copy of one of Octavia Butler's novels on the streetcar or whatever they do in LA. Mm. And then it was like her imagination broke open and now she's writing. And it cuts to my heart that somebody thinks that because they've never seen it, they can't do it. So that's where I would hope it's going, is that more of us have just sort of know that we can stand up and make what we imagine.
You've been listening to writers Nalo Hopkinson, Nnedi Okorafor, and Jewel Gomez.
And we're wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. And thanks to all of the contributors today, especially to Making Contact Radio. Feminist Magazine is produced by a coalition of feminist volunteers. You can find all the links from our program today on our website, feministmagazine.org. Find us on Facebook and on Instagram, or just email us at feministmagazine@yahoo.com. Our programs are archived in the kpfk.org audio archives. You can find our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play. Thanks for listening.
Coming up this week on LA Theater Works.
While attempting to discover the roots of Hamlet's unhappiness, two courtiers go on a journey to plumb the depths of the universe's mysteries.
What's the first thing you remember?
The first thing that comes into my head, you mean?
No, the first thing you remember.
Ah, I've forgotten the question.
How long have you suffered from a bad memory?
I can't remember.
Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead by Tom Stoppard. Next time on LA Theater Works.
That's this Sunday evening from 10 p.m. until midnight. LA Theater Works right here on KPFK.
Many listeners make KPFK possible by giving what they can. Some donate monthly, others give once a year, and some give in a big way by donating land or real estate that they no longer need. That unused cabin, a vacant lot, or a home that's no longer in use, Those properties can help ensure a future for your community radio station. Real estate donations can come with tax benefits for you and lasting value for KPFK. It's easy to start. Just visit kpfk.org/real estate or call 1-844-277-4663 and learn how your gift of property can make a meaningful difference.
Support for KPFK comes from a screening of the documentary Steal This Story on Friday, April 17th, 2026, as a fundraiser for KPFK. The event takes place at the Lemley Royal in West Los Angeles with the screening at 1:10 p.m. and 7:10 p.m. Democracy Now! Host Amy Goodman will be in attendance for a Q&A session alongside filmmakers Carl Diehl and T.L.S.